Hey, you got the morning show here on Raglan Community Radio. That was TV on the Radio with Wolf Like Me, and we're ready for our first interview this morning. I've got Jeff Reed and Pete Russell here in the studio. Welcome, guys.
Hey,
good morning. Good morning.
So, do we call you guys Weedbusters? Is that the easiest way to pin down what you do in the world?
Weedbusters is a handy generic term, but there's actually an organisation, a national organisation called Weedbusters, which generates a lot of really good weed control work. So we're not really part of that,
yeah.
Although we had a lot to do with them.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess we're just keen to see our forests protected. So, yeah, weeds are a big threat.
This is the thing. The thing I didn't really appreciate till I saw your guys talk at Science Night last night at the Harbourview. When I think of weeds, I think of the problems I have at home with them, or I see them on farms and things like that. They take over there. I didn't think much about. The only thing I knew about that was affecting our forest was wilding pines, but. That feels like the tip of the iceberg after what you guys were talking about last night. If we could put it in perspective, I kind of had this question because there were vines in there that were like taking over and eventually would destroy the forest where they were. So I was wondering, if we did nothing at all in this country now to try to stop that from happening, would we eventually lose all our forests?
Yeah, good question.
Our native forests?
Yeah, good question. I guess the first thing is that we're really focused on environmental weeds here, plants that invade and are a threat to the natural environment.
Right.
Which is the
ones we think about mostly.
Yeah, the ones we smoke.
Yeah.
Oh. It's too early, man.
Sorry.
There's a myth out there that if we just let nature take its course, that the natives will eventually win the war against the weeds. This is something I was led to believe a few decades ago, but then quickly you came to realise that the reality of the world out there is that that is not the case. If we let nature find a balance, that we're going to lose a lot of natives in that process. Environmental weeds are as big a threat to the natural environment as predators that we've come to know and hate.
Okay, so if we just leave our forests alone, because it looked to me like once a particular weed got into a forest, it just killed everything around it over time.
Yeah, you're dead right on that one. We basically are leaving our forests alone. There's some key groups around the country and passionate individuals that are out there fighting hard to try and slow the spread, to try and put up some sort of defence of the weed tsunami that's coming.
Yeah.
But basically, yeah, we are actually leaving our forests alone because we're not aware of the weed threat as a nation yet. And what we're seeing and what we're documenting and what we're witnessing is the death of these ecosystems.
So you guys don't want to answer the question, could we lose our entire forest if they were left alone for enough time?
It would certainly have a major impact on the ecosystems. You'd have some natives left, yes, but you'd have such a big impact on the ecological processes, and not just forest ecosystems, but all ecosystems types throughout the country.
Yeah.
And you kind of touched on this before. We're not just talking about creeping vines. We're talking about tree weeds. We're talking about ground cover weeds. We're talking about exotic ferns that have invaded the bush.
Yeah.
And something that's really struck us recently is that we're also talking about epiphytes, things that live in the treetops. And these are normally plants that live on the ground, but some of them are capable of colonizing the treetops along with the epiphytes, which not only has an impact in that part of an ecosystem, but it makes it very difficult to control things.
If we want to wipe out certain weeds like climbing asparagus, and it's got the potential in some forests to grow up in the canopy, you can get all the last ones on the ground. We need arborists or technical drones or something to get up on the top. So every weed you get now to slow down that incursion and protect our forests is really important.
How do you even find them when they're up in the canopy? Drones, I suppose.
Yeah, but or train up our native birds maybe to
attack kiwis. I was just trying to get a handle on the scale for listeners because I thought it was quite dramatic in the end what I understood from what you guys were showing. And it's kind of weird, like vines get in, and you showed one photo of vines on a forest floor, and I've seen a forest like that out at Waitatuna. I remember my kids started trying to pull the weeds up. That was kind of their instinct, and it wasn't killing the trees, but you said it was going to stop any seedlings coming up.
Yeah, that's right. So sometimes we look at a forest, and if it's got the understory smothered out by weeds, and that could be weeds like wild ginger, Pete, or Tradescantia, which we call wandering dew.
Yeah.
And so those are covering the ground, which means that any seeds from the big Tuakana trees, the, you know, the bigger, older trees that land and want to grow to replace that. They're the next generation of, you know, they're the children of the forest.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not there. So we're looking at basically retirement villages where we've fenced off and we're protecting all of our old people, but we've sent all the children off to war and they haven't come back.
Right, and so yeah, eventually you'd just be left with a vines on the ground.
Yeah, basically vines, or depending on what weeds are there.
Yeah, and the other thing too I picked up was that it's the vines that are shade tolerant that are the ones that are going to do it, because if you get a vine that's not shade tolerant ends up in the forest, it's not really going to thrive, is it?
Yeah, that's right. There are some shade tolerant vines, but there are many other kinds of plants that are shade tolerant too that are capable of invading a forest, like holly and ivy, for example.
Yeah.
So this kind of leads me to another myth, which is that intact native forests are relatively resistant to weed invasion, and there's some truth in that. But there's so many exceptions that it's a significant problem. And of course, a forest ecosystem has an inherent rate of natural disturbance. You have floods, you have slips, you have trees falling over, and they create light wells, which are an opportunity for exotic weeds to invade. And we're speaking from experience, from having seen this in relatively intact forests and national parks and scientific reserves, where, yes, at a glance, it all looks great. Look, it's wonderful on postcards, but when you get in there and check out the reality on the ground, you find that these weeds are hop, skipping and jumping throughout the landscape. And the ultimate result of that in 50 or 100 or perhaps more years' time is that these weeds will eventually become more and more dominant in these ecosystems. And then that pushes out the native plants and animals that are sensitive to having their habitat modified in that way.
One of the interesting things about this for me is that sort of the mythology of the country is we did the damage to the country in the past. The Europeans came and knocked down forests everywhere and to create farms, and we introduced pests that we shouldn't have. And we all know about gorse. We all probably had personal experiences with gorse that we regret. But this feels like this is just happening now, and lots of new plants as well.
Yeah, it's something that that's been recognised in the last 20 or 30 years, really.
Yeah.
But most environmental weeds, as opposed to agricultural or other weeds, came into the country as garden plants. And some of them have been here for a long time, since the 1800s, things like old man's beard, for example.
Yeah.
They've had a long time to get out into the wild. And in the 1980s, when awareness of old man's beard and the concept of environmental weeds was brought to the fore, that was a time when, yes, there were relatively few of these things in the wild, but there's a lag. There's a number of decades during which weeds can get out there and establish in the wild without too many people noticing. And then suddenly you get this exponential growth phase.
Right.
Because the gardening fad really kicked off in the 60s and we started bringing in hundreds of exotic species back then, they've now had 60 years or so to spread into the wild to an extent that's become noticeable.
Right, so this is probably the gardening. So I didn't realise the gardening fad started in the 60s because I wasn't around then. But that's might be the year zero of this problem.
Yeah, what we see for the way that weeds are spreading, and if you look at native pest animal, sorry, if you look at pest mammals that are impacting our native birds, basically stoats and rats have covered most corners of both islands, pretty much every corner of both islands.
Yeah.
The weeds are still around the townships. They're spreading down the roadsides and they hop out of people's gardens. And yeah, there's weeds that were introduced from the 60s onwards, but there's plants that were brought over by early settlers, and we often see those around farmsteads still creeping around. But we're at that low incursion rate, that low incursion, part in the curve.
Yeah.
And we need to act pretty fast.
All is not lost. Yeah, so a lot of these weeds have escaped from the towns and gardens and got into the hinterland, the modified landscapes dominated by rural farming areas.
Yeah,
And they're tickling the edges of the wilderness.
Yeah.
So yeah, we've actually got a window of opportunity now to get those under control and to push them back using clever strategies that a number of people have developed using the tools at our disposal.
Yeah.
And protecting as much as we can while there's a chance to do that.
So before we get into that, I just want to go back to the gardening issue, because I want to know if that's problems from gardening, if there's new plants still coming. That's what I want to know.
There is a screening process in place to keep out plants that are likely to go wild.
Yep.
It's not 100% effective. We're sure that there have been plants brought into the country in the last 10 or 20 years since that screening process was put in place.
Yeah.
That really shouldn't have been let into the country. So that needs to be tightened up. And the main way that comes about is public pressure. Yeah. The only reason that screening process is in there is from campaigning by the likes of Forest and Bird and the Institute of Noxious Plants officers in the 90s.
So if I went to a garden centre in Hamilton now, would I find plants that you guys would be like, don't get that?
I'd say most likely. I haven't been to that shop, but most likely.
Okay.
Yeah. Even at the warehouse, we're seeing an invasive fern being sold at the moment called macho fern.
Yeah.
Sold as an indoor plant, but it can grow outside. It's a bit like tubular ladder fern, which a lot of people are familiar with. Long runners would easily take over volcanic-y type habitats or coastal habitats, and it's not banned yet, so it's still out there to be sold. Ivy is another one. Ivy you can still buy.
Just old-fashioned ivy.
Just straight English ivy.
Yeah.
Stuff that can climb right up to the top of big pine trees or big native trees and seed profusively. And
that's why we like it, because it can climb walls. Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah. You guys are ruining all our plants.
There are alternatives out there.
There are. Well, this is good to know. Yeah, because I mean, I'm joking, but I know that for some people, there's kind of an attachment to these things. So if you can provide alternatives, that's got to help.
Sure. Those attachments do come at a cost, I have to say.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and that's the message that you guys have got and that I'm wanting to share this morning. So
yeah. But also to put that in perspective, you know, there's an estimated 30 or 40,000 species of exotic plants in New Zealand, compared with about 2,500 native plants.
So the whole world has come to our door.
But we're not saying that all 30 or 40,000 of those need to be removed. Only about 2 or 3,000 of those have gone wild, those exotic plants. But only, about maybe 400 or 500 of them are a problem. So it's not that we're against all exotic plants even all exotic plants that have gone wild. It's just those that are super invasive that really present a threat to the native vegetation and habitats that we're concerned about.
And there is a point of view where people think, oh, yeah, it's exotic, but it's really good for the birds. You know, the birds really love it.
Yeah.
And that can be quite a tricky one for people to, you know, talk to their neighbours about when you're pointing the bone at their plants. You know,
so
for
can
example,
you say the native birds like it?
Yeah, our native birds like it, and they get a feed out of it. But they take those seeds back to the native bush, where that one species will take out a whole plethora of native plant species, which means that not only can the bird feed from that pest plant in, let's say, February month, but now that plant's gone back into the native forest, many of the other months of the year, the trees that bird relies on for food are now smothered and taken out. So although it might look nice in your garden that the kereru comes to feed on your bangalow palm, when it takes it back, it's pushing out the niko palm or it's pushing out other species which provide food throughout the year.
So it's actually worse that the native birds like it. It's better if it's one that the birds don't like. Yeah, okay. And let's talk about those palms too, because oh no. Are we going to talk about our phoenix palms here in the main street of Raglan?
I'm not sure if they're male or female, but certainly most palm species, I know in Auckland all palm species have shown signs of spreading, except the Kentia palm is actually quite good. It's too big for the birds to eat, but bangalow palm is a real problem.
So that's not what we've got here. You said the bangalow palm looks a bit like the niko palm?
Yes.
Is that the one last night?
I'm sure they will be in the township. I haven't taken a proper look around, but bangalow palms are quite popular and they're still being sold at nurseries around the country. I think Auckland is the only region that has banned them so far.
Why don't we just plant niko palms if they look the same?
Well, it comes down to the nurseries. They want to grow things that are fast and easy, and they can make a quick buck. And the niko palms take a little bit longer than exotic palms, which is what they're supposed to do because they grow in a forest environment. They don't choke out our native plants. So.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So that's a thing. Like we all want fast growing plants. When we get an empty section and we plant, we want a hedge. There's a hedge plant now that does grow really fast, and that's great because we want the hedge to work right away. But then after about 5 years, you're left with this this thing that you're having to maintain quite vigorously, And I also wonder, I don't know the name of it, otherwise I'd ask you guys about whether it's actually, it's a problem as well.
Yeah, well, quite often people grow monkey apples as hedges.
Yeah.
And a camellia. And there's a lily pili, there's a purple one as well that the nurseries have been promoting because it doesn't seed as well, or the genetic, you know, it's not as viable, the seeds, but it only takes one of those seeds to grow, get out, and then that tree's, you know, established, and it might take a few more decades, but, you know, we will see that become a problem too. And you can plant certain natives like mapo or red matapo alongside monkey apples, take yeah. down the hedge and still keep your privacy.
Okay.
Yeah, there are ways.
So let's try and talk a little bit about strategy. I know that you were talking about some areas where the invasive plants had taken over so much that it was almost impossible, or maybe was impossible, to get the land back. I guess if you used like bulldozers or something like that and started again, you might. But, I mean, yeah, what's your approach to all of that? Because some of that seems impossible, and you're also saying that because our eyes are drawn to those really bad places, we're missing where the some other work can be done. So just tell us about that.
Yeah, there's a lot to that. Well, like I said before, it's not too late to protect most of the best areas, most of the highest value conservation areas.
Yeah.
We need to prevent weeds getting into them to an extent that, you know, the only option is a scorched earth policy. It's really the hinterland, the areas between the towns and cities where the gardens are, where the weeds mostly come from, and those natural areas way up the back blocks. It's those in-between areas that are highly disturbed where there's lots of opportunities for weeds to get out of control to that extent.
Yeah.
So one important part of a meaningful strategy is, instead of focusing on the big eyesores, the big, huge infestations where you might naturally be drawn to start your work,
yeah,
it's far better strategically to take out the outliers, the little far-flung, small infestations of weeds, because you have a much greater impact overall on the distribution of weeds and their spread by taking out those outliers first.
Yeah.
It's a really well-known principle internationally in weed control that people have realized after doing things and spending a lot of money focusing on the biggest infestations first and then learning the hard way that it would have been much better to start out with the outliers.
Yeah.
And another thing is that's really become clear to Jeff and I, working on a lot of high-value sites that are isolated, including islands, that a degree of isolation from weed sources is really important. So everyone knows that when we have an island that's surrounded by water, it's a really big advantage in terms of preventing animal pests, predators, getting to the island. So it's a sanctuary for our native birds that can't handle that predation.
Yeah.
But that degree of isolation is also really beneficial when we're talking about preventing weeds colonising an isolated site. And this also applies on the mainland, where you have, say, an isolated forest reserve that's surrounded not by a sea of water, but by a sea of grazed pasture. Grazed pasture is very hard for environmental weeds to spread across, because any seeds that drop into the grass are eaten by livestock.
Okay.
There's a few exceptions to that, but by and large, environmental weeds can't handle that kind of environment.
Yeah.
So what you end up with, effectively, if you've got a reserve surrounded by pasture, is a meaningful buffer from weeds.
Yeah.
Quite often, you haven't got 100% of that pasture that's grazed. So you might have a roadside or a railway line. You might have some houses with gardens that enable weeds to hop, skip, and jump across the landscape. So what the strategy that we've developed and are implementing in a number of places around the country is getting people to focus on those little spots in that landscape where weeds have an opportunity to live and produce seed and spread. And once you take those out, and we might be talking about less than 5% of an area within 500 metres of your reserve, once you take those spots out, then you've got a buffer, a meaningful buffer of 500 metres. Now, a buffer of 50 metres is an advantage. Okay, so it's not like you have to have several kilometres.
That's easy for birds to get across that, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But the further away, the less chance of weeds landing in your site. A lot of birds will eat fruit with seed in it. And then excrete them before they go too far. Birds don't like to have a full belly when they're flying. It takes a lot of energy to fly. It's a big investment.
That makes sense, actually,
And often birds will excrete those seeds as soon as they land somewhere. So that might be on the edge of your bush. But the further away you are from the seed sources, in general, the less likely it is that the seedlings will come up at your site.
So if we look at our Whangaroa catchment, you know, I don't need to explain what a catchment is. If we were to treat that as our area that we had to look after, what would the process be to do that? Like, research first seems to be your catch cry, really.
Of course, yeah. Like, you don't know what, you know, you don't know what you're dealing with until you know what you're dealing with, and that means doing a proper survey. And it can be good, easy for an individual too. There's some good tools out there. One tool that we promote heavily is using iNaturalist. It's a mobile phone app or a web app. iNaturalist. Now you can download that. You can take a photo of a weed and you can upload that. And if you don't, even if it's a native, if you don't know what kind of plant that is, iNaturalist, that's going to tell you what it is. And it will also put a pin on the map, so you've got a location, you know, you've got a record of where it is. For us, we've been, promote going around and doing a proper survey. So, you know, looking at all the species, how they're distributed, and also looking at your high biodiversity areas, your areas that you really want to protect and keep there, and sort of work back from there. So like Pete was saying, creating weed-free buffer zones around your biodiversity hotspots.
Yeah.
And also, if you've got really bad infestations of weeds in one area, creating a weed containment zone around that and working on the outliers so we can start rolling back the tide.
Okay. So that's a lot of work, though, for an area of this size, because we've got a harbour here, so our catchment area is quite large.
It can be a lot of work for certain plant species. Other plant species might only just be in the township here, you know.
I mean, you're saying there's how many invasive species? 2,000, was it?
There's about 2,500, 3,000 exotic species that have gone wild, but only about, I don't know, 400 or 500 of those are invasive weeds.
Still a lot to recognise.
Yeah, for sure. There's some main ones that are really bad. And, you know, it can be easy for people to get onto those ones, like tree privet, like wild ginger.
Yep.
You know, there's some gateway weeds out there, so we recommend starting on.
Gateway weeds.
There's a bit of learning to do. The Weedbusters website is really good for getting a start into growing your knowledge of weeds.
Yeah.
You know, not everyone can be an expert. And so we get roped in every now and then to do an initial survey just to identify what's going on in an area. And we've surveyed a catchment recently in the Bay of Plenty where we had 200 species of weeds on our radar, and we found 155 of those and mapped them. So sometimes you need to rope in experts, but it's amazing what community groups can achieve. And, you know, most weeds are in settled areas where people are, and people is what we need to control weeds, so it's a perfect marriage in some ways. You can have a big impact just in your backyard, you know. Do what you can where you are.
Yeah. For sure, and not everyone has to learn those 150, 200 species of weeds that are most likely around here.
Yeah.
But if we start talking about, hey, what is that plant? Is it safe? You're bringing a new plant into the garden, or you want to plant that. Is that a native?
I think that's the first thing we could do is stop bringing in the plants.
For sure, we've got to turn the tap off.
Yeah, that's easy. Like, although, we go to the garden centre, we want to plant, we don't know, there's probably, like you say, just a handful there that are potentially problematic, but, I mean, yeah, how do you know that?
Yeah, it's a really good point. You know, people quite rightly assume that plant shops, which we actually tend to call weed shops, will only sell something if it's benign and it's not going to be a problem. And there are plenty of people that sell plants out there who are responsible and know what they're doing and avoid selling weedy things. But there are some unscrupulous types that just want to make a fast buck, you know.
Yeah.
And it was only because of campaigning in the 90s that quite a long list of 100 or so species is now banned from sale.
Yeah.
But that's not all of the weeds that we would like to see banned from sale.
Mm. Yeah, well, we'd like to see a white list of plants that you're allowed. And if the plant hasn't been proved to be a safe plant, then it doesn't get on that list, rather than is that plant, you know, a banned plant? Oh, we don't know yet because it hasn't spread. And then as soon as it does spread, oh, now we're going to ban it. Oh, now it's too late.
So that's just the precautionary principle.
Of course.
At work, yeah. and it makes a lot of sense. But there is, has someone written a list somewhere for us to check? Or?
No, that would be, that would actually be a big job, but it would be a worthwhile thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, we just want to make it easier for people because, you know, like we say, not everyone can be an expert on these things.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, now, there was one thing you talked about. You talked about the issue of potential issues around riparian planting. And I don't know if you know the history of our catchment here, but we're very proud of the awesome riparian management that we've done and how it's taken our harbour from like one of the two worst harbours for fishing in the entire country to one of the best.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you're not saying riparian management in itself is bad, but it can be a corridor for weeds if it's not done right.
Yeah, in some parts of the country, we've seen a lot of money and effort spent on riparian planting. And if the weeds aren't looked at and controlled around those plantings, then what we're seeing is these plantings essentially becoming weed dispersal corridors or weed dispersal highways across the landscape through what were really good buffer zones when animals were grazing them, to now weed dispersal corridors going into our remnant areas. And if the weeds aren't looked at as well at the same time or before we retire that land, retire that stream to do planting, quite often we get a net negative gain for biodiversity.
Right. And that's not what we want after all that work.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing what's been done here. It's really inspiring. But yes, we can tick both those boxes. We can protect the water and we can do something that's really positive for biodiversity, getting those corridors back, increasing the biodiversity of native plants, and managing the weeds and preventing them from colonising those areas that are just planted. Because planted areas, you know, by their nature, their scattered nature, they're quite sun-drenched. Young vegetation is quite vulnerable to weed invasion.
Yeah.
And it's really like a sink for weeds that get attracted to those areas.
So do you need to budget for several years' worth of checking for weeds and pulling them out after you've done your planting?
Definitely, definitely. How
many years would you say?
Well, it depends what weeds are in the vicinity. Really.
Okay, but, and how fast the plants are growing. Then.
Exactly. I mean, you don't want to be stopping doing weed control follow-up within 5 years, and some plants around there, you want to be visiting that place every every year if you could.
But, yeah. Well, if it's on a farm, if it's on a farm, you should see it every day, you know. Like, I imagine, just if it's just on your mind and you're working the farm.
For sure. I mean, the beauty is that we are still in the low incursion rate zone for the graph. You know, the weeds haven't fully exploded yet. In some areas they have, don't get me wrong.
Yes.
But we still have an opportunity to wind back the infestation levels.
Because I was just thinking about our mountain here, Mount Karioi. It's got what you describe as the farms around it that can protect it, the native bush, and then it's got the sea on one side. So there's not a lot of places where you can get incursion, but then we've done all this riparian management and there's all these little lines going up to it. I don't know if they go all the way up to the bush. Maybe they don't need to. Or maybe you just would. Maybe that's one way of doing it, so it stops 50 metres short of the bush.
Yeah, well, 50 metres is still going to have birds flying. It's just not as much.
Right. So, okay, 200 metres. Yeah, and then it's, what are you doing? Yeah, it's not
worth it. Well, it's a concept worth considering, yes, stopping the buffers before they get too close to a site.
Yeah.
But, you know, there might be a good reason to plant riparian zones that meet an isolated bush reserve.
Yeah.
But you've got to make sure you've taken out those weed sources before you give them a chance to spread up those corridors.
Yeah.
And maybe you need ongoing management in some of those corridors because the weed sources near them are taking a long time to push back. We can't afford to let those weeds eventually reach places like Mount Karioi, because once they get into that bush, it's going to be a hell of a lot more expensive and time-consuming and damaging to control them.
Mm.
Yeah, and we know that there already are weeds in there, such as climbing asparagus, which is a nightmare. It can grow in the dark. It's a wee little vine which just chokes up and smothers every little seedling that's coming up, so it stops that next generation, and it's in there. And that is something that I wanted to speak to as well, because, you know, we get... You know, both Pete and I really don't like using herbicides.
Yes.
I used to be very anti-herbicide. We don't want to touch it on us, and certainly don't want it around our food, to eat, you know. But when it comes to looking after our biodiversity, it's the lesser of two evils in our eyes. And sometimes when you're really sick, people are really sick, they'll go for that rongoa that's quite harsh on the body, you know, to clear that sickness out.
Yes.
And that's the way we are also viewing weeds in the environment. It's not, some of these jobs aren't just for volunteers to go out on a Sunday and have a little bit of an impact, which is something I'd like to talk about just before we finish.
Okay, we've got to actually wrap up in a minute. So.
Yeah. But for weed control, sometimes it does take skilled contractors to get into those remnant stands of forest and, you know, strategically, surgically remove those plants.
Right. So yeah. So there's a place for groups of people casually doing stuff, and there's a place for the specialist thing. And when it gets really bad, serious. Work needs to be done. That's what I'm getting. Yeah, bulldoze. I was honestly looking at stuff last night, thinking you got to bulldoze that and start again. I couldn't figure out what else you would do.
Yeah, well, forestry,
that was my feeling about it. You know
how forestry landscapes, they reset the landscape to grow forestry. They fly helicopters over and spray harsh chemicals so that they can plant pine in, and it's not just a mess of pines coming up.
Yeah,
and sometimes it's that bad, but we don't want it to get that bad.
But those strategies are available, I guess. Now, what was the thing you wanted to bring before we wrap up?
Yeah, just if people want to take action and join the movement. There is a really active group in Whangaroa called Whangaroa Weed Busters. You can find their Facebook page.
Yep.
That's Whangaroa Weed Busters, and supporting grassroots volunteer efforts to keep to help each other kill pest plants on reserves and roadsides. This group is always looking for people to come and join them and help them. Lots of tools, lots of laughs on the days. Friends of Kaitoki Walkway, they meet at 9 a.m. on the first and the third Saturdays of every single month. So there's usually a morning tea provided, and it's a good opportunity to come and make some friends and do something really good for the community, but do something good for the environment. And there's an email address if you would like to get in touch.
Yep.
And I'll just read that out. That is whangaroaweedbusters@gmail.com. You can get in touch with Leanne.
Yeah, and we might have Leanne for a chat on the air in a few days or a few weeks' time. I'm not sure I know I'm going to do that, because she's probably one of the best people to talk to locally, I'm guessing, to know where we're at in our area. Yeah, because all you guys saw on the way in was our roads. You had concerns. Yeah, okay, screwing up their faces. Okay, well, look, folks, we've been talking to Jeff Reed and Pete Russell, Weed Busters. Thank you for coming to Raglan Whangaroa last night and coming on the air this morning. I know you prefer to sleep in, but we appreciate you making the effort, so thank you for that.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to move on. We've got an interview with Meraki coming up in just a few minutes.